This is Science Moab, a show exploring the science happening in Southeast Utah and the Colorado Plateau. I'm Peggy Hodgkins, and today we are talking about uncovering mysteries of the past with the newest curator of anthropology at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science.
My name is Erin Baxter. I am an archaeologist by training, and I'm a curator at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. My interests are in the ancient U.S. Southwest, but as a museum curator, I've gotten to work and do things all over the world. Like right now, I'm working on poison, and I, last couple summers ago, worked on recovering a pilot from a B-17 crash during World War II, worked in Tunisia and Greece and Egypt, but mostly in the U.S. Southwest on ancestral Pueblo history.
I wanted to get started just to kind of set the scene here. I wanted to have you explain in your own words, what is the relationship between archaeology and anthropology?
It depends on where you study anthropology. Like if you study it in Europe, you actually major in archaeology. If you study it in the United States, you study anthropology. And there are sub-disciplines. So if you can imagine a big umbrella that is anthropology, under that fits four different fields: linguistics, biological anthropology, cultural anthropology, and archaeology. If I can back up, linguistics is the study of language. Cultural anthropology is a study of sort of living groups of people who are not like ourselves. Biological anthropology is the study of the body and how it evolved and also how we interact with natural environment like food and medicine. And archaeology is the old stuff, the things that people have left behind. So if you cram all four of those together, you really get a pretty holistic study of humans, past, present, and future. We always dabble in each other's sorts of fields, but by and large, we study one of those when we go to school.
What part of the interactions of these sciences, what part of them do you enjoy most?
I love the archaeology bit. That's what got me into it, because it's outside, it's teamwork, it's problem solving, it's mystery finding, and it's interactive. And I'm kind of a visual learner, so I love that part of it. But as I've gotten drawn deeper into Southwestern archaeology, I realized that archaeology is not standalone. So as I learn more about ancient and modern peoples, and I'm interested particularly in the practice and in ancient burial practices, and that is not as okay as it used to be. I mean, for a variety of reasons, there's a long history of archaeologists behaving not as we should with human remains. But what I've learned is that, like, I work with biological anthropologists who study the body, and then I work with indigenous descendant communities and their wishes and their own histories and oral histories about how ancient people lived. And then language plays into that as well. So we can't stay in our bubbles. We have to sort of branch out to be the best archaeologists we can be. And we're still learning. We're not great at it yet, but we're miles better than I think we were 100 years ago. So it's a learning process every day, and it's relationship building. I think we really are adding to the canon collaboratively this time, as opposed to as sort of colonizers into understanding the ancient past.
Erin's research includes the interpretation of artifacts and architecture and how these analyses shed light on the development of social and political organization in order to reconstruct the deep history of Pueblo society. One of Erin's personal favorite topics in her research is death, or rather the archaeology of death.
I don't love death. No living creature probably loves death, but I do think that the physical body of an ancient person is a gift. And that's because a body is a time capsule of the past, right? They lived in that space and that time, and their bodies are manifestations of what was there. So not only can you learn about, you know, sex, we learn height, we can learn general health, if they were injured, if they maybe had a disease, all of those sometimes are written in the bones. But we can also now learn more things, and this is where science is really fascinating. You can do, of course, DNA studies, which are amazing and giving us hugely important steps into migration patterns and occupation relationships of individuals across time and space. You can also do strontium isotope analysis. So if you took the tooth out of my back of my mouth, hopefully I was dead at the time, but you would know that the isotopic studies, and you are what you eat, right? The isotopic studies of my molars would show that I grew up in Central Texas on the Edwards Aquifer, and the chemical signatures are still in my teeth because that's what I grew up with. And then if you find my body, say in Denver, where I am now, you can tell a story of migration based upon where I grew up and where I originated from, and then where I died. I sort of loved doing that. And I teach a class called The Archaeology of Death, or used to, at the University of Colorado Boulder. With my students, we would show them casts of things, and we would look at, broken femora and, left hands of a crushed individual, all plasticized and things like that. But they're speakers for the dead, literally, figuratively, actually, in what life was like in that moment, in that time, in that place. And if we can study them sensitively, I think they are just a wondrous gift to us as researchers and as humans of the 21st century.
So you're trying to uncover clues, like you said, mystery of how these ancient people, not only the physicality of what they look like, but what were their lives? How did they live? How do you go about doing that scientifically when you're out there? What are you looking for?
Well, we are fundamentally science-based. So, because of that, we ask research questions. So, my research question when I was in school was, how did ancient people in the US Southwest live? And when I sort of studied them, and you go to Santa Fe or you go to New Mexico or Arizona, where many descendant communities live to this day, and you see the remains of Mesa Verde or Chaco Canyon or Waupaca or wherever you go, you sort of see bones and sticks and rocks, and you can't imagine what it was like. And I had a professor who taught me we're always guilty of under imagining the past. And I think that's something that I wanted to push back against. And when I read about it as a student, when I read about ancient people, we read about often Pueblo people. These are the descendants or the sort of the ancestors of modern day Hopi, Zuni, Acoma, and 23 living tribes in New Mexico and Arizona and others. We read about sort of the egalitarian nature of their current living, but there's not a lot of hierarchy. I had a professor, his name was Steve Lex at the University of Colorado, and he sort of said, what if they weren't always this way? And we hypothesize that, or some archaeologists hypothesize that, because what you can see hierarchy mostly, and you can see it in the body. People who are better off are physically healthier. They're taller. They have access to better foods, better proteins. They tend to live in bigger houses, and they tend to be buried with nicer things. Those are sort of three really simple ways of doing it. There's other ways to get at these sorts of questions. But if you look at a place like Chaco Canyon, which has like one building there, and there are 12 of these called a great house. It's like five stories, something like 800 or more rooms. Don't quote me on that, but a lot of rooms. Pueblo Bonito was the biggest building in the United States until about the 1880s when a tenement was built in New York City. You think, well, that might be a place where lots of people lived, but we don't see a lot of trash. We don't see a lot of burials. We don't see a lot of stuff there. So people living in big houses that aren't occupied, who are those people? And the hypothesis was those are people who are in charge of things, who are important for a variety of reasons. And I wanted to get at, for instance, the hierarchy of the ancient past. And was there one? Is it testable? Because I think in our Western, again, this is sort of a white sort of notion. We see a display in a museum of a Native American community. It's dioramas, it's stagnation. There's not vibrancy and color to it because as they are now is how they always have been. And they have been this static sort of myth of this noble group of humans who haven't changed much over the time. And I think if there are histories like with hierarchies and with kings and queens and witchcraft and death and violence and unpleasant things, because unpleasant things, unfortunately, are the ones that show up in the archaeological record. But if you see those unpleasant things and you imagine into the really lovely things that might have come on the other side of that, you see a vibrancy of history that might come along with that. So I thought by studying the hierarchies and the power structures of ancient groups of people, you might actually return a level of what a Westerner would call history, which we've whitewashed for a variety of reasons, to colonize, to subjugate, to convert, to a group of people who have had that taken from them. But you have to do that not as a white person, you have to do that as a collaborator. May I help? And so these studies become complicated. So I think I have arguments to be made for it, but my arguments come from historical burial data found by people who dug this 100 years ago, white archaeologists, largely from the East Coast. And it's not okay to talk about that. I am not of the position or internal to various groups of the of tribal groups representatives to be able to sort of say that. So I'm, it's science, but it's science with a level of 20 and 21st century complexity that comes from our colonial past. And in a post-colonial world, sort of where do we fit in? So I think it's relationship building, and I think it's going to be really interesting to publish on this one day when it's okay. And when trust has been rebuilt, and I think archaeologists in the 21st century are making great strides to do that because we've got a lot to make up for.
Well said. And can we go into that more? Can you talk about what are some of the hypotheses and also what evidence do you have that this hierarchy existed?
Yeah, so great. And again, I want to share that this is not my idea. I'm just riffing off of ideas of earlier archaeologists. And also, this isn't a mainstream idea either. Lots of archaeologists like Barbara Mills from the University of Arizona see power structure, Louis Bork, other archaeologists see power structures maybe a European tool to get at an understanding of the past, that it's not relevant to groups of people who may not have had those same sensibilities. But I see power as a universal human phenomena, power and authority. And when you get groups of people together, leadership emerges. And I don't want to equate power with something negative, but a lot of times it was. But if you look at other groups of indigenous communities, non-Western, the Inca, the Aztec, there are levels of power and there are levels of empire. And I think that in North America, if you look at a place like Cahokia, which is on the near St. Louis today, and the sort of the power structure that was going up and down the Mississippi River and the southeast sort of the United States and beyond. And then you look at an analog of Chaco Canyon, I think you see organization, you see interconnectivity with like road building, you see similar elements of construction and elements of that are invisible construction. So if you and I were foreigners who were sort of walking by those places, you wouldn't know how they were built because those elements are invisible. But if you are an in the know kind of person and you know there are footer trenches and intramural beams and things like that are not visible, then you're part of that group. So because you see that in this huge area that goes from northern Utah and Colorado, the southern stretches of that, all the way down into southern New Mexico and parts of Arizona, it's a huge region that's linked together with signaling systems and roads and material culture, like we would say, pots and other sorts of things like that. And we see trade coming in. We see lots of stuff coming into Chaco, physical stuff, but we don't see a lot coming out. There's a reason behind that. There's a reason that people are sending things into a place and not getting much in return. They're not growing lots of corn there. They're not sending out trees and pots. All of that is from somewhere else. And those are indicators. Those are just the tiny whispers in the past of how maybe things were structured. And when you can't see something, but you can see things working around it, you can hypothesize into that black hole of what we don't know, which is we can't see power in those sorts of things. But when you put that all together with really significant burials, genetically linked humans who are related to each other with really fancy grave goods, who are living in these major, huge structures, who are trading from California to Texas, bringing parrots and macaws and chocolate from Mexico. These folks had power. And that's my sort of hypothesis. And what I've been looking at over the last few years of my life to understand this is the excavations that happened in the early 20th century by the explorers from the American Museum of Natural History, the Smithsonian, the exploring parties that were funded by folks on the East Coast, and looking at the archival material. So I'm not digging up anybody, and I'm not looking at a physical bone. I'm just looking at photographs and records so that I can excavate an archive to understand how this is. So we're at like 14 degrees of separation in sort of time and archaeological distance and ideas, but I still think you can think into the problem, and I think it's demonstrable when you put all of those sort of little bits and pieces together to say it's a very likely thing that there were people in charge, they were significant, and a place like Chaco was far-ranging and wide-ranging enough to have power to control lots of people over a large period of space across 2 centuries.
In your discovery and theorization, have you talked to many indigenous peoples? Are you welcomed to have these conversations?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, this isn't my, I mean, this is like Steve Lexon's and others' ideas that I'm sort of riffing on. I was his student. And he has talked to many indigenous people and has found that just like other groups of people, there's different opinions on that too. When I started this early on and I wasn't as schooled in understanding my language choice and how I went about this and how consultation should have happened earlier in my research when I was just a graduate student, when I first presented this, I have to say that an Indigenous person came up to me and said, That is secret and that is sacred, and you probably shouldn't be talking about that. So I really backed off because I did take him at his word. And since that time, and I've been working at the Denver Museum, and we've been doing repatriations under lots of different laws. And my predecessors, Steve Nash and Chip Caldwell, really were at the forefront of this, so that our museum is in compliance as far as making sure that the things we have are not, associated with burials, or burial objects or humans, and they're all 99.9% of them are all back home where they should be. We've done one consultation. But in the process of that consultation, you get to meet tribal historic preservation officers and representatives from various tribes and meet on a human level. You go have a beer and you talk about it and you gain trust. And once that trust is gained, then I think you can begin to make forays into making sort of these larger claims and talking about data from the past that were problematically collected and problematically sort of published, and see if it really is fruit of the poison tree, in which case set it aside and do some other things, or if it's important enough and interesting enough and sensitively presented enough in a way to be able to tell what I hope to one day tell, which is, I think, my best guess at the complete history of these cultures from the past. But we just can't go blundering about and doing it like we've done before. And that makes it harder. It makes it infinitely harder. It's why I have this gray hair here. But as I get older and as I'm beginning to meet more collaborators or potential collaborators amongst Indigenous community members, then I have more hope that it might one day happen. But I would never do it without permission, without explicit permission, because it's not worth more hurt in that sort of area of study. It's really not.
I mean, what is your thought on why these civilizations went away?
There's really good theories behind it. And again, I would cite my advisor, Steve Lexon, who sort of talked about this, that he thought that Chaco Canyon wasn't a really great place, that it was a place where people were in power and people were demanding of authority. Now, not usually authority is a two-way street, right? We give up our right to like decision making and authority, and in return we get and our money and things like that. In return, we get fire protection, police protection, and military roads, teaching, things like that. So we give up some of our autonomy and we get something back in return. Well, probably Chaco was something of the same thing. We're going to give into, we're going to bring trees, we're going to bring pots, we're going to bring food, we're going to bring meat, we're going to bring drinks, we're going to go to Mexico and pick up this chocolate for you, and we're going to go to California and get you some nice shells. And we're going to buy into whatever religious, political, social order that was of the time. But it might not have always been happy. Or also, we're going to provide labor to build these huge structures. What others, some see and others contest, but a guy named Steve LeBlanc sees, Steve Lexon sees, everyone's named Steve in Southwest archaeology, is that during Chaco, there is relative sort of a peaceful period of time, as they call it. Steve Lexon calls it the Pax Chaco, when things are kind of quiet, all quiet on the Western Front. And these buildings that are sort of cookie cutters of what was happening in Chaco, they're called big bumps for a reason. They're like these, multiple story with a kiva internal structure, mid into the south. Maybe it's a little scion of a community of something that was more important in the center. That all is well and good, and that lasts. But sort of in the middle of that, there was probably alternative forms of violence and probably alternative forms of unhappiness. So when Chaco finally succumbed in the early 1100s, its after effects, which was at Aztec ruins, also sort of was burned and disappeared. Most Pueblo people went away and never came back. And that was unusual because Pueblo people are migrants for a reason, and they move around to different places to farm, to take on new resources, to meet new people. Migration is part of their worldview. But migration back to those places never happened. And the oral history is that it wasn't a pleasant place. And there is oral history and mythology associated with sort of those places and times that it looks like they weren't going to come back because something bad happened there. And this is told to lots of during repatriation and consultations. It's mentioned a lot that it was an unpleasant time and an unpleasant place. And so consequently, Pueblo people said, we're not doing that again. They left that material culture behind. They left that black and white pottery. They left mugs. They left other forms. Bill Light writes about this beautifully. And they went down to Santa Fe and they lived in big community structures. So you no longer were in these diacritical or exclusionary buildings. You had these big one-story structures around big old plazas where everybody could come together. Nothing was done in secret. Everything was out in the open. A new material culture with glaze wares was happening. Some would argue, and I am among that crowd, that this was a complete pushback of never again will we live like we did during that time period. And that's a purposeful pushback against that hierarchical structure. And I think the remnants of this, and what we see this in the 14th century and beyond, is truncated by, Spanish incursions, which happens, 200 years later, is that this is the survival mentality of Pueblo people and how they made it through that horrible Chaco period, and then they pushed back and survived that colonial period that happened with the incursion of the Spanish.
Well, I mean, can you point to any actual pieces of evidence that support? I mean, what, I know you're not, like you said, you're not out there digging it up, but what did they find at Chaco to really express that unpleasantness?
Well, I mean, they found beautiful things at Chaco. They did find these exotica. So they found tens of thousands of turquoise beads. They found obsidian. And I think it's really clear to see that there was real authority and really real monetary wealth in Chaco. And you see the burials represent that. And then when Chaco ends, and it just people sort of move north to Aztec, probably to be near water. When that place ended 150 years ago, and that's the area that I studied, there were some really unfortunate deaths for some people who were walled into rooms, who had stakes driven through their pelvises, who showed signs of physical abuse. There were rooms with lots of infants who were buried at the same time in something that was something horrific that had to have happened. So, for that, when I look at those sorts of things, and then I look at those really horrific burials that are associated with material culture, particularly mugs and things like that, that are representative of Chaco, I tend to think that there's pushback that Chaco was the past and we're not doing it anymore. And we're going to move away from this and we're going to go live in a totally different way. So I do think there's revolution there, getting at it and being able to get into a position with indigenous communities to be able to sort of talk openly about that because the data are problematic with how they were originally gathered. That is my mission in the next few generations, if I can live that long. And if I can't, that's okay. We'll pass it down to the next generation to go after.
Well, Aaron, thanks for talking with Science Moab.
Thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
To learn more or listen to other Science Moab episodes, visit sciencemoab.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Our theme music is by Jeremy Spaulding, and the show is produced by Peggy Hodgkins and KZMU. If you love Science Moab, support us by sponsoring the podcast, writing us into your research grant, or donating at sciencemoab.org. This programming is unique to Moab, Utah, and your support makes it possible.